I'm happy now to welcome Eric Blinman. He is the director of the New Mexico Office of Archaeological Studies. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So it's great to have you back. Let's talk about climate change from an archaeological perspective, which we don't usually do. This is presumably the first time that climate change has been caused by human beings, or any species for that matter, but it's certainly not the first time that human beings have had to adapt to climate change.
Yeah, and I think that's really the big lesson. What's interesting is that I deal with a whole bunch of people who actually don't believe in modern human-caused models of climate change. And it's interesting to try to change the dynamic of the discussion, not from whether or not CO2 is a problem, whether or not there's a morality associated with changing from fossil fuels to something else, whether or not science or politics is right in the current discussion, but really to take it back into the question of, well, when we know that climate change really is real and it's not a debatable subject, how did human beings react? How do we apply those lessons to our own future?
You work for the Office of Archaeological Studies. How is it that you're coming into contact with lots of people who don't believe in human-caused climate change?
I work in a really broad world. Even a couple years ago when I got to go to a major climate and human response colloquium in Greenland, one of the two climate researchers who was invited to it was a disbeliever in CO2-caused climate change. He feels strongly, and still feels strongly today, that climate change that we're facing now is a consequence of natural solar cycles, and that our obsession, in his words, with human-caused climate change is really sort of a red herring. I also work with people who are politically very conservative, and they feel that there is so much, it's wrong to stereotype it as liberal agenda, but really that's what it amounts to in their minds, liberal agenda that has tainted the interpretation of climate change in ways that have nothing to do with climate change at all. So I get to deal in this very, very interesting world of ideas that is not really black or white when it comes down to the issue of climate change.
So for you as an archaeologist looking at climate change, what are you looking at? What does the archaeological record tell us?
Well, we have a tremendous advantage here in the Southwest. First of all, we get to look at climate change because we have some of the best tools in the world for looking at climate change in the rearview mirror. We don't have to model it. We don't have to anticipate what might be happening. We can go back and look at what did happen through tree ring records, through pack rat records, through pollen records of changing vegetation on the landscape.
Pack rat records?
Yeah, pack rats collect all kinds of debris from the vegetation around where they live, and so they sample that vegetation, and it builds up in the middens, and then we can date their little middens and know that juniper really did grow right in their vicinity, or pinon pine, or that there was no juniper or pinon pine in the vicinity. So their little middens contribute to the study of climate change from an archaeological perspective.
Amazing. So how far back are we talking about? What is the earliest record of climate change in the Southwest that you're looking at as an archaeologist?
For our purposes, we go back about 2,000 years. After 2,000 years, the record starts to thin out, in part because the high-density tree ring records we have depend upon human beings going out and cutting down trees for their houses. Once they've cut down the trees for the houses, they can get preserved in archaeological sites, and then we can recover the samples and add to these deep time records. And we've got dozens of these across the Southwest. You can't characterize the climate of the Southwest from just Mesa Verde or just Chaco. You've got to go all the way up into northern Utah. You've got to go all the way down as far south as you can go in New Mexico and build a network of stations. Because what is a drought in one area can be a really bountiful rainfall situation in another area.
Even in the same period?
Even in exactly the same period. In fact, Santa Fe has been sort of on the border of those oscillations, if you will, so that there's a period of time from, oh, probably the 1190s all the way to 1500 when the climate was so significantly different than it is today that you could farm corn down in the Galisteo Basin, an area that today all you can do is raise cattle or shoot movies.
What types of climate change? Give us some examples of what people here in the Southwest had to endure and how they endured it.
Well, the variables of climate that are important here in the Southwest really fall into sort of three categories. One is temperature. It can be warmer, it can be colder. The second variable, of course, is moisture, how much rain is falling. But probably as important as how much rain is the periodicity. Was it coming in the monsoon pattern that we're used to, or was it coming in some slightly different pattern? So we're playing off those variability in those three aspects of climate in trying to reconstruct climate change on a regional basis. The importance of all of this really doesn't affect, well, it does affect hunter-gatherers who are on the landscape as of 4,000 or 6,000 years ago, but it's a far more abundant record and a far more sensitive record of human response to climate change after people become dependent on corn. Corn germinates with soil moisture that's left over from winter snows, but if it doesn't get the summer monsoon rainfall, it can't be carried all the way through to a mature crop. And so as soon as people become dependent on corn, we have a very, very delicate balance between climate and human economies and social systems.
So the dependence on corn, when rain stops falling in its regular pattern, then the corn doesn't mature, then people go hungry.
That's right. And if it's just a drought, if it's just a one-year phenomenon, any decent farmer has saved up enough crops in their storeroom that they can get their family through a year of crop failure, maybe even 2 or 3 years of crop failure. But if that drought is persistent, if it starts to move from drought into climate change, then the farmers and the farming communities as a whole have to usually pick up and move or stay in place and die. And human beings don't sit like, you know, frogs in pots of water as it slowly boils.
So you see evidence of migration as a result of climate change?
The first consequence of climate change is usually some adjustment in population, either through decreased fertility or increased mortality, as people really struggle to reclaim their way of life. I mean, we all live in a state of denial. We all want things to return to what we felt was normal. And so people try that for as long as they possibly can. When it's absolutely clear that there's a new normal and that it doesn't work anymore, then the principal option for all people, even today, is migration.
How does climate change reduce fertility rates?
Through disease and stress. A woman cannot be as fertile when she's not getting as much nutrition. Children die more often in infancy, and that's really more in the fertility line than it is in the mortality line. The other aspect of mortality is intercommunity conflict, as well as susceptibility to disease. So there are social aspects as well as physiological aspects to the equation of past demography.
When we look at today's climate change, we have, for example, proliferation of insects, whether they be mosquitoes in malaria-prone countries or bark beetles in places like the Southwest. Do you see things like that? Do you have any way of studying things like that 2,000, 4,000 years ago?
We do. Things like the bark beetle infestations are probably real and timeless, that when a big pinyon-juniper woodland is subjected to the sorts of droughts we've been subjected to here recently, the bark beetles will attack it. we have an interesting phenomenon where in the Pueblo III time period up in the Mesa Verde region, that's really the 13th century, we see a lot of pottery firings, and mass pottery firings, out in pinyon juniper woodland areas. And there are beetle galleries in some of the wood that's being used to fire the pottery kilns. And it's likely that they're taking advantage of this temporary good supply of high-quality pottery firing wood due to the climate stress and due to the killing of the trees.
I've seen a whole line of furniture called beetle kill pine.
Human beings are incredibly creative with the way we try to salvage our economies, and that's a pretty good, interesting way to salvage it.
Yeah, it's kind of pretty. It's kind of greenish.
Yeah, I'm sure we can find a silver lining in just about every catastrophe that happens. What's fascinating is when you look at photographs of the hills of Santa Fe from 100 years ago, they're absolutely barren. There's no woodland up there at all. And the only reason we have a pinyon juniper woodland is because artificial sources of energy were brought in. You know, gas for heating homes, fuel oil. Those sorts of alternative fuels that came in the last century allowed the return of the pinyon juniper woodland because people stopped cutting it for firewood.
Right. We're talking to archaeologist Eric Blindman. So what were the causes of climate change in the past?
That's a really interesting question, and I don't know that archaeologists are capable of answering it. We can look at the local phenomenon, we can make sense of what was happening, but the ultimate causes can be as far removed as changes in the Pacific Ocean sea temperatures. So we don't know for sure what they are just by looking in the Southwest. We can go broader than that and turn our climate data over to people who are studying climate systems worldwide, and they can try to make sense of it in terms of worldwide situations. One of the interesting results of all of the climate research that's been going on of late is that all of what we would consider complex human economies and societies, that is the Neolithic Revolution, farming, all have happened in the past really 8,000 years, which is a protracted, unusually protracted warm period in the Earth's climate history. Usually the Earth is in glacial, interglacial conditions. It hits a warm peak for a matter of decades to centuries, and then it descends immediately back into glacial conditions again. Well, this is unprecedented, what we're going through now in the past 8,000 years, and all of the climate change that I'm looking at in the Southwest is nothing but micro variations within this long, protracted warm period.
What is unprecedented?
How warm it's been, and for how long, because usually it trips itself back into an ice age. In fact, that's one of the you know, if I were to live long enough in our present climate, and if the CO2 models are correct, we're driving toward unprecedented high temperatures. Something in that high temperature peak kicks in an ice age cycle. And if we thought global warming was bad, it's going to be even more difficult for life the way we know it to cope with a descent into an ice age.
What makes a community resilient and able to deal with changes of climate, whether it be a contemporary, urban, whatever kind of industrial culture, or a much, much older culture of the kind that you've studied here in the Southwest?
Probably the easiest way to describe that is with the concept of carrying capacity. At any particular technology, we have a social and economic system that's able to support a given number of people. You change the technology one way or another, and you can reduce or raise that carrying capacity of a given landscape. As long as we are able to keep our population well below the carrying capacity of our environment and our technology, then we can consider ourselves resilient. if we push our population to basically very, very close to what our carrying capacity is, then we are extremely fragile. And any perturbation of the climate, any change in resource availability, like a sudden increase in the price of oil, can destroy the very, very delicate economic system that we're part of. And that's what we see in the past, but in a very, very sort of low-tech basis, where too many people are on the landscape, they're trapped into growing corn because there aren't enough natural resources to turn to should corn crops fail consistently. And corn encourages reproduction, it encourages population growth, and so people put themselves right at the limit of what their climate and their economy could sustain, so that when the climate changes, then something has to give, and it's either population reduction or migration.
In the world that we're living in now, migration is only possible up to a point because of national politics and because we've already got over 6 billion people on a fairly crowded Earth. Population reduction is something that would have to be done either voluntarily or through war and disease?
Yeah, it will happen naturally, if you consider war and disease natural, if we don't take approaches voluntarily that can reduce that. But, you know, archaeologists and anthropologists per se are not in a position to design the future of our society. We can reflect on it, but I'm not sure you'd want us to design public policy. We don't know for sure which way it's going to go, but I can tell you that if we want to survive well, we should probably reduce our population. If we want to maintain our standard of living, the quickest way in the face of diminishing energy is to reduce the number of people we have, because then we can maintain our per capita energy consumption and we're fine. We can invest in new technologies that make energy use more efficient. We can decentralize our economy so it's less subject to perturbations of specific resources. There are all kinds of things we might want to pursue. It's sort of interesting to me to watch the debate between science and politics, because ultimately that's the way we come to decide on a particular course of action. Whether that action ultimately is maladaptive or adaptive, we may not know until it happens.
We also live in a world which is based on the idea that the only way to have an economy is to have a growth economy. And the growth economy that we have has, when you think about it, used the Earth's resources so rapidly that it's staggering. I mean, I was watching a program by one of our country's leading oceanographers who was saying that 90% of the large fish that were in the ocean 60 years ago are gone now. Well, 60 years is a very short amount of time.
It's an incredibly short amount of time, and yet I've seen archaeologically change in whole societies that has been forced on communities over a generation. So it doesn't surprise me. We have a great ability to take our own situation and assume that it's constant in the past and in the future. And one of the advantages of archaeology is we can point out the fallacy of that view. And when anybody thinks about it, they recognize it. I mean, we have grandparents who are still suffering from the effects of the Depression. They still remember all that. And yet they buffered us from feeling that for the most part. And so we're relatively insensible to it. Now we get a little tiny taste of it, and we're, going, what is this? I actually, in some ways I'm optimistic, in some ways I'm pessimistic, that these sorts of lessons from the past are going to have some effect, and they're going to shape the decisions we make in the future. But, you know, we can have an incredibly rapid effect, especially with our modern technology, and we can be forced to respond within the framework, really, of just a few years. You know, certainly the ancient farmers of the Southwest, they had to respond as soon as their corn stores gave out, and their corn stores usually were sized for about 3 years.
Now, I think there are probably many people who think that because we have advanced technology and some of the greatest scientific minds in the world at work on these questions, that technology will just save us.
Well, technology has saved us. Technology has put us in the position of being where we are. In a big picture sense, technology will, and has and will, allow us to deal with short-term issues. I'm a little bit pessimistic that technology is going to be able to bail us out if our populations continue to grow as they are. And that's probably as simple as that. You know, here in Santa Fe, we've got the judicial complex fighting and having to spend huge amounts of money to remediate the spill into the groundwater of gasoline from, you know, gas station tanks. No one at the time that they were running those filling stations realized the incredible cost and effect of what that spill is going to mean, and it's going to destroy the groundwater for normal uses in that area for generations. Right now, they're just trying to get it remediated to the point where they can build a courthouse with a subgrade parking structure. But there's, you know, technology is a double-edged sword. If we don't use it well, we can make ourselves much, much worse off. If we, but in the short-term view, it was great to have those automobiles, and it was great to be able to fill up conveniently just outside of downtown Santa Fe. You know, so there's all of these bizarre trade-offs, both short-term and long-term.
You have written that it's important to have alternatives. Alternative models of economies that are not growth-based. Do we have any models of these from archaeology?
The depressing thing is no. The human populations that I study basically go through repeated boom and bust cycles. That as soon as a niche becomes stabilized in its economy and its environment and climate, that people then, in some senses, misuse that and grow their populations to the point where they become unsustainable as soon as some condition changes. So if there's a difference, it's that we can apply technology to everything from birth control to even social adaptations where we delay the onset of marriage and the onset of families, religious and norms of what family size is supposed to be. You know, we have...
Which is happening all over the world.
It's happening in several different ways all over the world.
Yeah.
I mean, Afghan families are confronting the fact that you really can't have 17 successful pregnancies for a woman. If you've improved the medical care to the point where most of them are surviving. You know, we have in the Philippines, one of the first exercises as a student that I ever faced in dealing with population imbalance was the social pattern of inheritance for rural Philippine families, where the house plot was the most important thing, and it was always divided for the children. But with improved medical care, so many children were surviving that they were cutting house plots down into little postage-stamped, little places for the surviving children of the family, and it just was no longer workable.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we have to really think about the fact, which so many people take for granted, that if you have two children, they're going to both survive, that's not how our history as human beings has been.
Right. And there's the interesting sidelight in all of this, in that as families have gotten smaller, the social value and the sort of parental value we put on each child increases. And so the trauma felt if something happens to a child gets correspondingly great. So that when families expected one out of every seven children to die, death was common in the community and it wasn't so hard on people. Now, if you've invested all of your parental concern into raising a single child and that child dies in a car accident, it's incredibly traumatic.
Do archaeologists have a place at the table in conversations about what we should do as a nation, as a state, and so on about climate change?
Generally, no. The interests that are at the table are, in some senses, the rarefied scientific interests that are battling over, really, is climate change happening?
And I thought that had been put to rest.
It has not. And there was, I think this past weekend in the New York Times, there was a summary of the economics of climate change. And most people think, yes, it has been put to rest, but it hasn't.
Even among, in the scientific community?
It's probably more put to rest in the scientific community than in the political community.
Right.
And
but that's what I mean. If you talk to people who actually study it, there is climate change.
Yes.
If you talk to people who have interest in there not being climate change, then they're still debating it.
Right.
But that's sort of like non-scientists debating, you know, arcane points about mitochondrial functioning or something.
If it weren't so serious, yeah. I guess what I'm trying to acknowledge is that this really is a political process, and all the science in the world, if it isn't perceived and recognized as such, is not going to go anywhere.
Right.
You know, the concept of evolution has been proved. In quotes, for well over 100 years. And yet there are sections of our society that completely deny its relevance as a model for how the world works.
Well, and the Catholic Church finally admitted Galileo was right, I believe, in 1992.
And those sorts of things happen. You know, ultimately, I think the only way that I, as an archaeologist, is going to inform the debate is actually having discussions like this that bring out the issue not so much as an issue of specific climate change, but as an issue of human ecology. That we have, you know, I can sit down with a rancher from Torrance County who is incredibly conservative, and I can have a very, very positive conversation with him whether or not he believes in climate change if instead I approach the conversation from what values do you want to pass on to your children? What aspects of your way of life do you value and want to see them enjoy? And if that becomes the focus of the conversation, then we find out that we have tremendous commonalities that completely cross-cut the concept of liberal and conservative, that cross-cut, you know, climate change deniers and climate change proponents. What I hope is that archaeology can broaden the debate so that we can focus on human ecology, so that we can return a sense of complexity to school educations, where instead of teaching an answer to a particular problem, we teach how to approach problems in a very, very strongly multivariate sense, because nothing is cause and effect. You can't look at this winter and say, oh my God, it was very, very wet, therefore climate change doesn't mean anything. Like is happening back in Washington, D.C., where
right.
It was so cold and they were saying, oh, global warming, see, this proves it's wrong.
Right.
Well, no, because as you warm the atmosphere, you're going to put more moisture into the atmosphere, you can get tremendous snows in the winter just because things are warm.
And because at the poles, it's a whole different story than in the middle latitudes.
Right.
Eric Blinman is the director of the New Mexico Office of Archaeological Studies. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.